I can go in the closet.
At some point, the cats might scratch at the door. Might just have to deal with that.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California, and with me today, instead of my normal co-host, Richard Wally, who's celebrating his anniversary this weekend, we have friend of the show, Keith Foster from San Diego.
Good. Things are good.
Things are good. I follow you on Facebook because we lived together for like 8 years.
Yeah, we're best friends, some people might even say.
Some people.
You were the best man at my wedding, even.
I was. I don't think I've met anybody like any of your new friends, any of your new cool San Diego friends.
Oh, man, they'd be so happy you said that.
That I called them cool? Or that,
yeah.
Or that they've supplanted my usefulness?
Yeah, I mean, that you would call them cool and that they would consider me friends. I'd be like, aw.
Wait, are you outing yourself right now? Are they not your friends?
No, they're definitely my friends. If any of them are listening to this, you're all my friends. All of you. I know all your names.
They're just not your best friend.
Yeah.
Well, there might be some work for them to do then. Specifically, you just said you got out of a meeting. Because you've just been promoted to a co-host of a nightly comedy show, right?
Yes, yeah. All listeners, check out tonightinsandiego.com. We come back in April. There's not a lot right now. A lot's under construction. We have a YouTube. We have a website. We actually have a podcast that I guess I'll be featured on much more now.
Mm-hmm. I listened to the one episode you did.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good time.
You almost name dropped the podcast. You said, my friend does a movie podcast, and then you failed to say the URL, but that's okay.
I know. I name dropped so many other things, too. I name dropped the comedy project. I name dropped Dropout Student Films. I mentioned you, didn't get the name out. I listened to it, and I was like, oh, I'm an asshole.
It's okay. I just stopped listening after that point.
But there was nothing left.
No. I listened to it. And actually, I have caught a number of your segments that you've done on the show because you're a segments writer, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm staying a segment writer, even though I'm the co-host.
Mm-hmm. From me to you, because we've talked about this a little bit off air, off and on, and I've sort of followed, I guess, your career. Do we call it a career yet?
Hopefully in a year.
In a year. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to hold you to that. I'll ask you if it's a career in a year. Career okay. In a year. That's your
career
new goal.
In a year. Yes.
Put that on your refrigerator, on your spirit board.
Did this just become you made it weird? Career in a year.
How is it going to work now that you're a co-host? Like, what does that mean? Are you going to be the Andy Richter to whoever's Conan?
Yes. Jesse Egan, he was the co-host before. He is now taking over as the host, and I'm taking his spot as the co-host.
Okay. Are you guys pretty pumped about the lineup change?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Jesse is super nice. He's really funny. He's very charming and charismatic. We get along very well. It's going to be fun to see how that dynamic, like, changes between us, how it kind of adapts. Because we haven't we haven't done like comedy together. You know, like I've written sketches for him and stuff on the show, but
yeah,
we haven't like riffed together a whole lot. But I'm excited for it. I mean, he's largely recognized as one of the best comedians, if not the best comedian in San Diego. So just like the fact that I get to work with him on a weekly basis is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And outside of Tonight in San Diego, you've also done, a little bit with your improv roommates / wife. And you've done some stand-up as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, just kind of open mics. I've gotten booked for, you know, random gigs here and there. Nothing really insane yet. Kind of the same with our improv troupe, TCP West, mm-hmm. Which I would tell you the full story about the name. You know it, but the ongoing joke is now that TCP stands for something different every time. So if you come to a show, we'll come up with some silly meaning for TCP.
So it doesn't necessarily have to mean the comedy project?
No. In fact, we've officially decided that's not what it means anymore.
Okay. See, I thought it was like the Avengers. Like, there's the Avengers and there's the East Coast Avengers and there's a Great Lakes Avengers.
That was the idea.
Like, I'm waiting for the Great Lakes comedy project. Is there any Midwest comedy project members out there? Your old improv troupe from Idaho?
I think Brittany Borgie is kind of Midwest somewhere.
Near the lakes? Michigan, you know, Chicago?
I don't know how close she is. I don't know. I haven't talked to her in a while.
If you can cover the two coasts and then the Chicago Midwest area, then you've basically franchised successfully.
Yeah, well, so that's, I mean, part of the thing is the original Comedy Project members that moved to New York haven't done a TCP East yet. Mm. And part of the joke was we wanted to beat them to it. And then we did fairly easily.
By doing it at all.
Yeah. By just doing a show and calling ourselves TCP West. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Is it West Coast specific humor? Is it a lot of jokes about highways and palm trees?
No.
Like that's the entire, like it's improv, but the only suggestions allowed is highways and palm trees.
We did get a suggestion once. We were doing a show in a neighborhood called University Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And for the show, we asked for a suggestion of a location and somebody said University Heights, mm-hmm. but not being terribly familiar with the area. I was like, where is that? Like, I don't know where that is. So we ended up doing the Grand Canyon.
Without ever telling them that you're changing the bit entirely. You're just like, no. Grand Canyon.
No. I said, I was like, I don't know enough about that place. Let's get another place. And someone was like, Grand Canyon. We were like, okay.
It would have been funny if you committed to it and just done it without knowing anything about it.
Yeah. In retrospect, we probably should have done that, but, mm-hmm.
To make up a lot of like really strange specifics about this area you know nothing about, like, oh, here's the famous skateboard park.
That's such the better way to go, because I mean nobody really cares if there's that one person in the audience going, that's not what University Heights is, like, you've lost them anyway. They're not paying attention to the show.
In fact, from now on I just say, do whatever the complete opposite of your suggestions be. See, that's why I don't think I could be a professional comedian, is I wouldn't want to actually entertain an audience so much as just troll them from the stage.
You know what, though? There's a long history of comedians that do that. Like, look at Andy Kaufman's.
Yeah.
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 Your Sacha Baron Cohen's, you know, like, it's just like, that's a type of comedy all in and of itself.
Oh, we're going to get to Sasha.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Here in a little bit. The Oscars happened.
Yeah.
Last night.
Oh, okay, so.
That was a transition. Did you have snacks?
Yeah.
Were snacks enjoyed?
Yes, snacks. Snacks were enjoyed.
The Oscar party I went to, I normally have Oscar parties with my with my grad school friends, but they were all too cool for school this year. Yeah,
weren't they LARPing?
Yeah, a couple of them were off at war in the woods of, I put that in quotation marks, by the way. They were at war out in the woods of God knows where, California, in chainmail and, I don't know, drinking mead and fighting with metal swords.
I want to be very clear that I'm not making fun of them, but that does not make them even close to too cool for school. That's like the opposite. That is like exactly as cool as school allows.
You're very right. And well, here's the thing about LARPing, or specifically that kind of LARPing. Like if you're just like playing with foam swords in a park and you get to go home at the end of the day, sure, knock yourself out. But the reason I didn't want to go, besides the fact that it was Oscar Sunday, it's too much like camping. You're going up there, you're going to get cold, you have to use like shitty utensils, and you're going to be sleeping in a tent. It wasn't going to happen.
Do they go like full on like LARP themed camping? Like they can only camp with what resources they would have had in like this medieval scenario?
You know what? Probably not. I guarantee somebody had like a iPhone playing Pandora through a little speaker or something like that. Like, but I know it's regardless too much like camping for me. And too much for like camping for me is like sleeping on somebody's floor in their apartment. So, but anyway, so I ended up going to this other friend's house, up in North Hollywood, and, he had a pretty good sized amount of friends there, most of whom I hadn't met. And the way he decided to do his Oscar party was because it was Oscar so white. That was the whole theme of the party and what ended up being the theme of the Oscars themselves.
Oh, we did have, Oscar's so white nacho Doritos.
Well, there you go. Everything
white cheddar nacho.
Everything Doritos. That he served, all the food that was on display, breads, cheeses, spreads, all of it was white. Popcorn.
That's terrific. He went further than we did. We had talked about doing like Oscar themed foods, like Bridge of Pies. Baked Brie Larson, Leonardo di Capricola, and oh shit, there was one more that I can't remember. I tweeted it. Follow me on Twitter.
Mars bars, Martian bars. I don't know.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. the Big Short cake.
Ah, you said you did an Oscar pool.
Did you
take like the voting sheets and all that stuff?
Yeah, we did. And it was okay.
How did you do points wise?
Oh, Mad Macaroons. Mad Macaroons. That was the one I'm forgetting. Points wise, I think I only got like 7.
Oh, okay. I did a little better than you. I got 12.
Okay, yeah. You would have won then, actually, because the person who won had took home with 11.
Right. See, they didn't have Oscar sheets. They didn't have like the voting sheet. So the way I had to do it is I had a little like pen and paper in my hand, and because I really didn't know the nominees off the top of my head like I normally do.
Yeah.
I just kind of like after they announced the nominees would pick one like, okay, I think it's going to be this, and I said it out loud so I couldn't like, you know, cheat or whatever. Yeah. And then I would mark it if I happened to get it right.
Well, the Oscars, I mean, they were all over the place with nominations. And
by the end of the night, I thought it was like they were drawing it from a hat. Like, it was that random sometimes.
The only thing that seemed consistent was Mad Max did surprisingly well.
I knew it was going to get most of the technical awards that it was nominated for, which it did. I think the only one it didn't win was for special effects of all things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which went to Ex Machina, which I was happy for because I love that movie. Mm-hmm. But that's like a case of right movie, wrong award.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I didn't see it, but I mean, you cannot argue with the effects. Like, there have been a lot of people on social media and stuff saying Mad Max wasn't that good or whatever. And man, are they wrong. But specifically the effects, like the practical effects were so much, like, everyone agrees that I've talked to that that movie is just like an adrenaline rush.
Right.
And I think a big part of that is the practical effects. Like, you can feel weight to things. When the cars are flipping upside down, you're like, oh my God, there was someone in that car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a tactility to the entire movie. It, like, and I think when we reviewed it, me and Richard reviewed it, I said everyone is in some sort of visible pain.
Yeah.
Whether they're overheated or sweaty or dirty or bleeding or something.
I was surprised that it took makeup and costume, though, because the Academy typically doesn't award like sci-fi kind of movies that they love period pieces.
Yeah, I thought was going to go to Carol.
I actually thought maybe The Revenant, because, you know, like there was some authenticity to like their fur cloaks and things like that. And considering how sort of basic they seem, there were some good design elements to it. So I was like, you know, it fits that period aesthetic that the Oscars usually like, but it's a little bit different. So I actually, that was one that I thought The Revenant would take.
Yeah, I was a little surprised about that. I mean, you know, we can go through the big five.
Sure.
Here. Yeah. I'll save Best Picture, but let's start with the supporting actress, which went to Alicia Vikander for The Danish Girl. Big surprise.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, like, literally, I was surprised.
No, both the supporting awards were surprises, because from everything I had heard and read, it seemed like Kate Winslet was sort of a lock.
Yeah, that's who I thought was going to win it.
Like, she won a lot of the, like, other acting awards from, you know, like, the other award shows. Mm-hmm. Like, didn't she... She won the SAG award, didn't she?
You know, I can't actually say for certain. I don't have that in front of me right now. But actually, here's what I thought was going to happen. I think I voted with my heart with Kate Winslet because I love that performance. And I'm, like, one of seven people in the entire world that really liked Steve Jobs as a movie.
Well, I think a lot of people were like, fuck Ashton Kutcher.
Right, yeah. They're re-releasing this? What are they doing?
Yeah.
But I thought that they would go with Rachel McAdams because my original idea going into the Oscars was Mad Max is going to win everything technical and Spotlight's going to win everything dramatic.
You know, I didn't expect it to win a lot of the acting awards. I thought that movie, Rachel McAdams aside, was so strong of an ensemble. Mm-hmm. I didn't think any one actor would stick out enough. I particularly didn't care for Rachel McAdams. I actually thought she was sort of the weak link. And it's not... it's just because I don't know. I don't really care for her. And maybe I'm blaming a little too much of her on True Detective season 2.
Right. I, you know, to be totally honest, even though I thought that Spotlight was going to win all the dramatic stuff, just I was going purely off of the momentum of the pre-award season because I think it won the PGAs. I was not that big into Spotlight. I was heavily underwhelmed by Spotlight. I thought that it was a really good episode of Law and Order.
Yeah, I liked it. I actually liked it quite a bit. I thought it was, as far as, you know, like a procedural reporting movie goes, I was thoroughly engrossed. I thought the characters were great. There were some, you know, heavy accents. But I remember getting very angry when I watched it. And then like a week later, I kind of forgot about it.
Yeah. See, I don't know. It wasn't bad. It wasn't like a terrible movie. I just thought it was so simple and it was so writ and everything about it was, there was nothing about it that I didn't feel was above and beyond the genre.
Okay.
I kind of dug, Michael Keaton in it. But that could just be because I root for him no matter what.
Well, he's He is one of those guys. I actually thought he might get a supporting nod.
And he did not.
No. The Academy just, they are do not care for Michael Keaton, I guess.
Did you see Bridge of Spies?
Bridge of Pies? I did not.
Neither did I. That was one of those ones I was meant to get to, but I didn't. Mark Rylance, who I had heard no buzz about at all, ended up winning Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere. Like, man.
That was a big what?
Everyone thought it was Stallone's. From what I've read, everyone was predicting Stallone.
I think everyone wanted Stallone. Again, I was going by my rule, and I had guessed Ruffalo.
I was hoping Ruffalo. Of the performances that I saw, his was my favorite. And, you know, I didn't see a lot of the other movies that got nominated for, like, Best acting picture. Awards. And of the Best Pictures, I didn't see Brooklyn or Bridge of Pies.
Me either. Those are the same two I haven't seen.
Yeah. But yeah, Mark Rylance, that was a surprise.
One of the guys that was at the party, I guess he had just saw him in London doing a Shakespeare or something or other on stage. He said he's like well known for stage acting. So,
yeah, I've heard things about him. I heard he was one of the best parts of that movie. I just he kind of came out of nowhere.
Now, best actress in a leading role. I wanted Brie Larson to win, and I voted with my heart, and she did win, so I was happy.
Yeah, no, I pretty much expected her to win. After I saw Room, I mean, I didn't really think there were any other performances that kind of approached it. You know, like it's such an actor's role, and she just nailed it.
Yeah, totally. And well, I thought it was between her and Cate Blanchett, but Cate Blanchett's won and / been nominated more recently. Which actually, Brie Larson is pretty. I mean, she's been around, she's done some things, and she's had a lot of praise behind her, but she's never. One could say that she's still kind of new to the prestige world. Yeah. So there might have been a lot of people who wouldn't vote for her just because of that. They're like, who is this girl? Why do we care? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I was very happy to see her take that award because I loved Room.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's hard. Like, even when they were just showing the Oscar clips for it, I was, like, getting emotional.
Yeah. Did you see how excited Jacob Tremblay got when R2-D2 and C-3PO and BB-8 went on the stage?
Oh, Jacob Tremblay is adorable. I'm very sad for the day when he Haley Joel Osment's and hits puberty and no
goes through his awkward phase and yeah.
Because he is just the damned adorablest. Damnedest adorable, most adorable. I don't know what the adjective there is, but he's just
totes adorbs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, everyone kind of called it, and it happened. Leonardo DiCaprio won for The Revenant.
He did. And it was, I think it was definitely more of a career award.
Legacy award, yeah. That's the way I feel about it. And, you know, there was uproarious, like, you know, I don't know, Brazilians at a soccer game kind of applause at the party I was at when it happened, because they were all apparently big Leonardo DiCaprio fans.
Yeah, it was a similar feeling for us. Everyone was sort of cheering. And you know, I do think he finally deserved an Oscar. But there, I'm not going to lie. There was a small part of me. There was a small, hateful, evil part of me that was like just hoping he wouldn't, because he was such a lock. And just like the internet memes we had to look forward to.
Yeah.
And just his reaction if he had lost, like, man, what a gut punch that would have been, right?
Yeah, that would have been an upset for,
like,
sure.
Do you think he would have just retired at that point? He's like, it's not gonna happen. Like, it's just not.
Or just only like started like making like Adam Sandler comedies or then that kind of stuff. Like, squandered his talent for the rest of his career.
I like to think that there's an alternate universe where Leonardo DiCaprio did not win, and that is what they have to look forward to.
Yeah. Now, I'm kind of with you, or maybe, I'm not sure if that's what you were saying, but I like Leonardo DiCaprio. I posted a thing on Facebook where I listed my top five Leonardo DiCaprio performance, none of which are The Revenant.
Yeah.
I have issues with The Revenant. I think that it's gorgeous and it's really ambitious. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of directing going on, but that's kind of what I feel like the whole movie is a lot of directing and a lot of acting. And I have a hard, it feels like everyone is really desperate to be awarded.
Yeah, I don't know. I have sort of a troubled relationship with it because when I watched it, I thought it was great. I still think it was great. I thought it was really good. And I don't know, this Oscar award season seemed so weird because there wasn't like any kind of real standout best pictures. Mm-hmm. Like it kind of felt like they just sort of threw out what they could for best picture. Not that, you know, I didn't think any of those movies were bad. It's just none of them really sort of stood out to me as the best picture, except Mad Max. Which I think was ripped off, but that's me. And so I think when The Revenant came out, it sort of felt like this collective like sigh of relief of, oh, we have that prestige picture. We have that Oscar movie.
Right.
And so I think that was sort of imposed upon it. Whereas if it had been released at another time, I think its critical reception might have been slightly different. But I still think it was good. I liked it. I still think Leo was good. Again, like you said, I don't think it's necessarily his best performance. But, you know, it was still a strong performance. It was worth awarding. And
he carries it. Like, I mean, you know, like it's fine. I don't have a problem with him in the movie or even the movie itself. I'm not sure, and I you could say this about a lot of bigger movies that Leo's been attached to, such as Inception or Gangs of New York or The Aviator. A lot of these things he becomes attached to because of his star power.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if there's anything he did in that movie that somebody that's a competent leading man could do. As long as you can grow a gross enough beard and crawl around and mumble and bleed from every orifice, I think you could be in The Revenant.
I don't know. From an actor's perspective, yes and no. I do think he manages this kind of intensity that seems genuine, that a lesser actor, I don't think, would have necessarily sold that. You know, because there's not a lot of dialogue in the movie.
No, it's not dialogue driven.
You know, so he does have to convey a lot through his physicality.
Leo a physical actor. I think that's what takes me away from it. Unlike Wolf of Wall Street, where I think a lot of what he's doing in that movie is very specific to his skill set and his celebrity and like all of the context that brings to the part. I think, you know, him playing a mountain man in the wilderness is. There's a part of me that always will think like he's just a little too pretty to convincingly frump up.
Can see that, but I don't know. I was never distracted by the fact that it was Leonardo DiCaprio. Like I said, I think I think he managed to sell the emotional aspect of it. Like I was convinced by him. I felt like he cared about his dead wife or whatever was going on there and his future dead son
and wanted revenge and
and the subject matter wasn't terrifically complicated. It's a revenge story, but I think he does have that emotional core that sort of that movie needed. I think he sold it.
Okay. I would say the star of The Revenant is Emmanuel Lubezki, who won for Best Cinematographer, although I still wanted Roger Deakins to win for Sicario. Not only because love Sicario, but also because Roger Deakins has never won a goddamn Oscar. And how is that possible?
See, I was actually, I was again rooting for Mad Max. I think the cinematography of that movie was gorgeous. And again, the fact that it was filmed, practically and just those action sequences, like every single one of those has this amazing sort of set piece that jumps right off the screen.
Yeah.
So I was hoping that would win.
Yeah. The look of that movie is very specific. And I think that it's, it's a big part of why the movie stands out as much as it does.
Yeah.
I don't love Mad Max like some people love Mad Max. I think it's a really, 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 really well-made summer action blockbuster, but I don't necessarily buy into the whole, like, feminist subtext and da-da-da.
Sure, I mean...
But I will say that under lesser hands, like direction, cinematography, technical-wise, under lesser hands, it could have just been a big cacophony of noise and grinding metal, Michael Bay jism in your face. And the fact that it wasn't that, and actually has kind of a real flow to it and an ebb and flow and a look and a style and actually like guides you through this thrill ride in a way that's like visually tolerable. Mm-hmm. That kind of is, it's saving grace. Well, not it's saving grace, but it's achievement.
Oh yeah. I mean, also just the fact that a movie was nominated for Best Picture that has a character named Coma the Doof Warrior, who is this blind flame guitarist strapped to the top of a big rig. Like, right. I wanted that to win so bad.
The movie's cuckoo bananas, like totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Cirque du Soleil on motor vehicles.
Yeah. And that was why I wanted it to win so bad is how more outside of the Oscar system can you get?
Mm-hmm. And then it went to Spotlight.
Yeah.
Which I kind of predicted that it might win. But by that point, I thought that the Revenant would win based upon the fact that Leo and Iñárritu won for Best Director and Actor. So I thought, oh, it's the Revenant's dramatic year. And then at that point, Spotlight felt like out of the blue.
Yeah. Well, I really hoped George Miller would win.
Director,
Again,
I
kind of thought he would, again, sort of like Leo, get sort of a legacy award. Didn't Iñárritu win last year?
Yeah, that was another reason why I was surprised that The Revenant got as much love as it did. Not only by the awards, but the awards season. I thought, like, Iñárritu, you had your moment last year with Birdman. And Lubietzky won 3 years in a row for Gravity and Birdman, and now for The Revenant, which he's an amazing cinematography, often works with Terrence Malick on, like, films like Tree of Life and The New World. But yeah, I was really surprised that they were just up on the Revenant train.
Yeah, me too.
But that was the Oscars. They happened.
Yep.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter because everyone will forget everything by this time next year.
Yeah, the world has not changed.
No, and I don't think it's really going to change all that much for the award season. And we didn't even talk about necessarily the telecast itself. Chris Rock, yay or nay?
I liked him. I was glad to see, you know, that the Oscars were at least self-aware enough to address the issue. I liked that they let him sort of have free reign. I thought some of the bits were really funny. The thing with Stacey Dash was the most awkward thing.
That was harsh.
Yeah. The telecast itself was fine. I thought Chris Rock actually was great. I thought he was the best host they could have hoped for this year.
He was actually hired to do it before the whole campaign started. So that was like, I don't know if you want to call that like kismet or not, but it was something.
I think it worked out in both Chris Rock and the Academy's favor.
I got a little bit kind of a weird, bitter taste of, about the whole thing, though, because it felt to me like basically Chris Rock had to bring it up. It was his imperative to bring up Oscar So White. And it would have been weird if he didn't. And good, it's good that he did. But I felt that the fact that the Academy decided, okay, the theme of this year is going to be we're sorry.
Yeah.
And like, and then you have Chris Rock up there making jokes about it. And then you have a bunch of white people sitting in their seats going, I guess we are a little racist.
Yeah.
Like, to me, the whole thing was a little like white guilt and
I think privileged and weird. I think that's sort of a to be determined. I think if the Academy actually looks at this and says, okay, we need to be more inclusive. We need to be more diverse. You know, if they actually take this opportunity to change, good for them. If they don't, then yes, that is, it will go down as one of the weirdest Oscars in history.
I thought it was pretty weird, but I think we, you know, we talked about it on the show a few episodes ago, me and Richard, we talked about the rule changes and like how the Academy is going to have a faster turnaround for membership and blah, blah, blah. So we'll see how that plays out altogether. But I want to, I just want to reiterate my opinion of the whole thing, which is who cares? It's the Oscars. It's an award show.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in seeing better roles and more roles being offered to black people. Like,
Well, I mean, I think that's ultimately the only thing that will really change it is, you know, and I think that's why this year stood out is because there were so many standout black movies and black performances that just got completely ignored.
Well, there was a film that won basically everything that mattered at Sundance this year called... it's what was that terribly racist movie from the silent era? The one about the KKK, like rescuing white women from black people.
Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
There's a new movie about actual slavery, a slavery drama written and directed by a black and starring a black actor that played very successfully at Sundance and got a lot of pre-awards kind of buzz. And we'll see if that ends up being the Oscars' big grand statement for their controversy this year, which may or may not be super annoying. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Let's go ahead and get to our review.
Okay.
Which is Eddie the Eagle. How much did you know about this movie going in?
Not a lot. I mean, I saw the ads.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a movie.
Sure is. It's directed by Dexter Fletcher, which you wouldn't know because all the advertising is really talking up. Yeah, talking up about how Matthew Vaughn's involvement, which he's involved as a producer only. It's written by Sean McCulley and Simon Kelton. It stars Taron Egerton, who starred in Vaughn's Kingsman last year, Kingsman The Secret Service. And Hugh Jackman. And it's basically your sports movie 101 kind of story, your underdog sports movie. Taron Egerton plays this, underclass, dorky British guy, based on a true story. He plays Eddie Edwards, who was a real athlete of sorts. And he grew up his entire life. As a child, he couldn't walk. He had to wear a Forrest Gump leg brace. And he eventually learned how to but he cured himself and was able to get off the leg brace, at which point he tried very, very hard to successfully become an athlete or an Olympian of some type, trying out every sport he could, not being very good at any of them. And eventually he finds his calling in ski jumping, even though he had never even tried it up until his mid 20s. But because there's nobody in England at the time to, compete, he was able to sort of learn how to do it fast enough to just barely qualify to make it to the early 80s or 1988, is it?
Yeah, 1988.
Yeah. And along the way, he meets Hugh Jackman, who plays a cantankerous ex-Olympian who is now just a groundskeeper at a ski slope. And he sort of begrudgingly tries to keep Eddie from killing himself / maybe teach him a couple things on the way.
Yep. That's, I mean, that pretty much sums it up.
What did you think of Eddie the Eagle?
Okay. I actually went into it a little skeptical. You know, it's just, it seems like such a dorky movie. And it is. But I couldn't help but enjoy myself despite all that. I thought it was a lot of fun. There's some genuine chemistry between Taron and Hugh Jackman. And yeah, I thought they did a good job of sort of balancing Eddie's home life with his career choices.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a good underdog story, watching everyone, you know, tell Eddie he can't do it. And then by the time he succeeds at doing at least what he set out to do, it's really satisfying.
It is. And I think that's sort of the key to these kinds of sports movies, is being able to draw a relatable enough character and a relatable enough circumstance that you can get behind their victory, however big or small it could be.
I actually, that was something I really liked about this movie, was the scale of what's like actually at stake is very small. You know, like pretty early on in the movie, they pretty much come out and say he's not going to be a real competitor or contender for any sort of medals. But his personal stakes were very high. And I thought the movie did a really good job of showing that. And as opposed to some sports movies, the sportsmanship message, I thought it felt a lot more honest, because you had this, you know, character that genuinely didn't care if he won or lost. He just wanted to prove something to himself.
Yeah. And I could get really highfalutin and criticky and say that there might be some sort of subtext about how in today's economy that you have to renegotiate your standards and your goals for ultimate success, and that success is relative. And, you know, there's some stuff in there about the British class system. It's very, very in the background, but it informs the Eddie character. And the fact that Hugh Jackman is playing an American who's teaching a Brit, you know, Hugh Jackman says, you have to wait. We can do this in 4 years. You're good enough to at least get me to convince me to train you, but give us 4 years and we can actually do our best, which is a very American idea. Like, if you're not going to do if you're not going to be the best, then there's no reason to do it at all. And he's like, no, I get to go to the Olympics. That's all I've ever wanted my entire life. I'm going.
Yeah.
Which is a very British kind of point of view. I'm happy with my class.
And that was what I, again, kind of liked about this movie was the period felt very fun. Like they, you know, they used the period well.
It's never like overblown, or it's never like gimmicky. Like, it's not like a Hot Tub Time Machine kind of thing where it's like, oh, look, we're watching MTV. Here's a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah. It feels like, you know, a pretty honest portrayal. I did like how they used, you know, like stock footage for like the opening ceremonies and stuff. Did you catch the Cool Runnings reference?
I didn't. I mean, other than the movie itself reminding me a lot of it.
Yeah. In like, there's this scene where there's a radio playing, like, I think it's when Hugh Jackman's watching him do the 70 meter jump, and there's just like this really quick thing where a news announcer's like, and up next we have a Jamaican bobsled team, and I was like, oh, that's like, me and my wife noticed it and we were like, oh, that's really weird, and I looked it up and that was the same Olympics.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so it was sort of a sequel to Cool Runnings?
I mean, I definitely thought a lot about that movie. And I thought a lot about, like, 90s Disney sports movies. Because they all had that kind of, like, earnestness. And but it's wholesome in a real believable way. It never feels, like, so saccharine that you can't stomach it. But
there was a little of that. Like, the whole And you get this in these kind of movies a lot when you have a character who drinks alcohol. Mm-hmm. But like Hugh Jackman referring to his alcohol as his jacket.
Yeah, that was a little heavy-handed.
And like the I don't need my jacket anymore. And then like they're drinking milk together and it's like, okay. So that I could have done without. But as a whole, you know, it was fun.
It definitely doesn't reinvent the wheel. It is one of those kind of movies. It's Rocky. It's Cool Runnings. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, any, you know, Friday Night Lights, like you plug in your favorite underdog sports movie. I was also reminded a lot of the hockey movie Goon.
Okay.
Reminded me a decent amount of that.
Well, I think also you kind of can't help but compare it to Rudy.
Yes. There's a few things in this movie that I think keep it from just being a cliche. And I talked mm-hmm. a little bit about that, but I think I really liked the character and I really liked Taron Egerton. I was very surprised by his performance in this movie. I talked to you a little bit before we went and saw it, and I said that I liked The Kingsman. I'm one of the few people who really defend that movie and don't think that it's just way too violent and way awful. I like the subversiveness of that movie, but I thought Taron Egerton was kind of a one note sort of broody teen kind of guy. Like I thought he mm-hmm. was basically sort of a Channing Tatum before we decided he was okay kind of guy.
Yeah. But you know, like you've just mentioned with Channing Tatum,
yeah.
he's sort of grown on us. I feel the same about Taron. Like I
didn't know he had this in him. I didn't know that he could play such a distinct character.
And such a not cool character. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, his character in Kingsman, and it might just be that's not a great first impression of him as an actor or even a person, mm-hmm. but he seems sort of, you know, he wears that snotty, like, British sort of punk rock attitude a little too well. Mm-hmm. It feels a little too honest. And so, yeah, I agree. I didn't, like, when you told me it was the same guy, I didn't even know it was him.
Yeah, and, you know, the big googly eye glasses and the messy hair and everything, it all helps. But he embodies that physicality without it ever feeling like an SNL character.
No, yeah, it feels like he's, you know, doing his best to portray this quirky, fun individual.
Mm-hmm. And the other reason I think this movie kind of succeeds is the specificity about the sport itself. I think one of the things we learn about is like the camera work is really, really good. Like when you get up way up on the top of those things and you slide down those gigantic jumps with the character, you're able to mm-hmm. actually kind of embody at least a fraction of what that might be like.
Yeah, no, I agree. I didn't even know this was a sport, and then through this movie realized it would be the worst sport for me to ever possibly participate in.
Terrifying.
Yeah. And I will give it credit. Like, there were some genuine, like, tension moments because of the way it was filmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is sort of goes without saying, but in lesser hands, this could just be, you know, whatever, The Big Green Part 5 or something.
Yeah.
But the fact that it wasn't is has a lot to do with the fact that it's just really well handled and really well directed.
I do have one question.
Sure.
Because, I don't know, you watch a lot of weird movies with a lot of weird sexual subtext.
Okay.
and so I think it's worth bringing up. Did you notice kind of a weird, like, I mean, they directly, you know, draw this analogy to ski jumping as this sexual
orgasmic experience.
Right? Yeah.
And there's a whole bit in there about Bo Derek and because she was famous at the time.
And like the culmination, I don't know, maybe spoilers. The culmination where he makes the final ski jump, like everyone's making an O face. and you know, normally that wouldn't have even popped up in my head, but the movie makes that comparison earlier in the movie. And then right before he makes the jump, he, you know, I don't know if it was Eddie or Hugh Jackman's character that's even like, Bo Derek. And then they all are making O faces. I was like, that's sort of odd.
It's one of those things that there's a few things in here that kind of help you remind you that it's not a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them. The other being all of the Hugh Jackman's smoking.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of a no-no for the Mouse House. But I think that there's that plays maybe kind of weird, a little strange, and maybe in a way that the movie doesn't know that it's doing. I think it was supposed to be basically a gag.
Well, because the
way that they integrate it all the way through leads to some strange conclusions. I mean, there's a few scenes in the movie that are almost explicitly homoerotic.
And there's this scene where the lady who runs the ski lodge is like hitting on him and he's very uncomfortable. And then later on, he's much more comfortable with Hugh Jackman. Like, I think there's an interpretation there, but
There's also a long tradition of sports movies being kind of homoerotic.
Yeah.
I think it's just one of those, like, they call it the Valley of Virility, where something can be so straight it becomes very gay. 300 sits smack dab in the middle of the Valley of Virility.
Oh, that's because it's pretty close to the Uncanny Valley as well.
Yeah, same idea. professional wrestling, UFC fighting. Well, good. I'm glad you liked it. And I'm glad I liked it too, because it's so traditional in a way and so kind of old fashioned and so wearing its heart on its sleeve that you almost want to root for it and hope that people go see this because there's nothing about it that's cynical.
No. And in your screening, did it have like a little thing with Taron Egerton or Edgerton or whatever and Hugh Jackman that are like, we just want to thank you for coming to the movies because we had a lot of fun filming this, and there was four people in the theater, me and my wife included, and it was just like, you're welcome, guys.
Yeah, there was that in mine as well. And then Brie Larson's speech about like, just thanks for going to the movies. Like, I don't know what that says about the state of Hollywood and getting people out of their homes and off of Netflix, but with the tiny amount of people, I had maybe 20 other people in the theater with me, there was some decent amount of applause at the end.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Good. That was like a mix of good and cool.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework then.
Oh God, I'm so sorry in advance.
It's okay. Well, it'd be very interesting to talk about this movie in conjunction with Eddie the Eagle, because they're both following very, very familiar tropes.
Yeah.
And maybe not doing it as successfully.
No.
You assigned Staten Island Summer to me. Now, we announced last week on the show, when I didn't know that Richard was going to be gone, that we'd be reviewing Talladega Nights, which was also one of your suggestions.
Oh, that's fun.
So we are doing that next week when he comes back. But you suggested Staten Island Summer, which I remember looking this up a while ago when they were still kind of filming it, because I was doing little news stories about the casting and that kind of stuff. And one of the things that really struck me about this movie, and I'm sure it's one of the things that struck you as well, is the big cast and a lot of featured players from Saturday Night Live, both present and of yore.
Well, it's a Lorne Michaels production. He produced it. The comedy pedigree you cannot argue with. Like, there's just every time you turn around, there's another comedian.
Yeah, well, we have Bobby Moynihan, Zach Perlman. He's from something.
Who's that? Zach Perlman?
He's the chubby friend.
Oh, him I didn't recognize.
I remember him. I've seen him in sketch comedy, and I think he's one of the key players in Key and Peele sketches.
I'm not familiar with him.
We also have Gina Gershon, who has a walk-on part in this. Fred Armisen, who's doing his best Bill Murray from Caddyshack. Cicely Strong.
Kate McKinnon.
Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on of all of these SNL guys. And Colin Jost
has a cameo
and wrote the movie.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
Mm, that might explain things.
He's a current news guy on SNL.
Yeah, and he took a little while to grow on me. Like, when he first showed up on SNL, I was like, who the fuck is this Wonder Bread? but then, like, when they paired him with Michael Che, like, I think they've found such a great rapport. They are quickly becoming a couple of my favorite Weekend Update anchors.
Okay, that's interesting.
It is interesting because literally up until like this most recent season of SNL, like I hated Colin Jost.
Because he was doing it with Cicely Strong before, right? Like they had a season together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They had a season, then Cicely Strong wanted to go back to sketches, which I think was a great choice for her. And then they brought in Michael Che last year, and it was pretty awkward and bumpy. But I think they're finding a good place with it now.
That's good. So why don't you go ahead and describe what happens in Staten Island Summer?
Ugh. Okay. So it's this coming of age movie about this kid who he got accepted to college.
Harvard.
Yeah.
Don't let you forget.
No. And so every summer he's a lifeguard at this swimming pool with his lifeguard buddies. There's this whole lifeguard culture there. And it's his last summer and his last weekend even. And so before he has to go away and never speak to anyone ever again, he wants to get laid and throw a wild party.
Mm-hmm. And sounds familiar.
Yeah, like every other fucking coming of age movie ever made. Like, it's such a mishmash of Superbad and
Caddyshack and Meatballs. And
you can throw in a little bit of Sandlot in there. It reminded me lot of The Way, Way Back, but not nearly as good.
Right. And not played as earnestly either.
No. I mean, they were setting this up as like the set of a farce.
Right.
Whereas The Way, Way Back was meant to be, you know, more of an earnest coming of age movie.
Mm-hmm. I think this movie really, really, really wanted to be Dazed and Confused, but it comes off as a poor man Superbad.
Honestly,
and it's not even the first of one of those, because there was a bunch of like Superbad ripoffs after Superbad, like Project X, which was like actually somehow surprisingly worse than this movie.
Wow, that's impressive almost.
But yeah, this was largely underwhelming.
No, like that's
selling it too high.
No, like, yeah, like, I was so disappointed because, again, that comedy pedigree, and I was just, like, nothing was funny to me. Like, nothing. I really wanted to like this movie. I was rooting for it.
Yeah.
And I just, like, man, crickets. Like, Fred Armisen was hard for me to watch.
I know. That was such a bummer, too, because I'm a big Fred Armisen / Portlandia fan. And maybe he was just edited very unforgivingly, but... first of all, he's in a completely different movie than the rest of the cast. And the movie tries to integrate that like in a Caddyshack way and just does not pull it off at all.
No, I mean,
it feels like digression at worst.
And it's so shamelessly ripping off Caddyshack, too. Like,
yeah,
you got this weird groundskeeper who has this feud with this force of nature that he can't control.
Mm-hmm.
So that was particularly bad. I cannot think of his name. Oh, Mike O'Brien, the villain. Oh, let's talk about Mike O'Brien for a minute.
Yeah.
I am a Mike O'Brien fan in general.
Yeah, I've seen him in a lot of stuff where I thought he was very funny. This would not be one of them.
No. I think he's... he was writing for SNL for a while. I really like him as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the cast for a season.
Wasn't he one of the ones that got fired in The Big Purge?
He went back to writing.
Oh, okay.
If I'm correct, I believe he's still a writer there, but I'm not totally sure. Whatever. Mm-hmm. I want to root for Mike O'Brien because I think he was just so miscast. Because okay, let's talk about this character at first.
The villain character that he plays?
Yeah, so they set it up with this weird, Goodfellas narration with the main character.
Right, it's a very lazy kind of like, hey, this is my best friend. We're going to not be together by the end of the movie. And here's the girl I like, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
and here's the character that you're supposed to hate. Don't you hate him?
Yeah, which the movie forgets about this whole narration device, after the first act.
Right.
And Mike O'Brien, sure, he's a nerd and he's kind of gross, but he's not that bad. He's just sort of a dude. And yeah, they try to make him so hateable, which, by the way, at the end of the movie, he gets murdered by the mafia.
Well, maybe not.
He for sure does. He gets carted away by the mafia for sending a dick pic from his phone to the mafia guy's daughter. Right. And it's like, okay, we're okay with them just murdering this guy because he's kind of unlikable. Like, that's fucked up.
And he's not even like agreed. He's not even that bad. Like, he's weird and sort of a tool, but like everything he says in the movie is pretty reasonable, which is like, hey, please don't have a giant party here.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff in the plot that doesn't even really justify itself. Like, the kid's parents leaves to go to Orlando to do Disney World, and he decides he doesn't want to go. Right after which, they're no longer allowed to have the big pool party. Why not just have the big party at your house where your parents aren't at? Wrote itself, and the fact that they didn't do that, I guess, I don't know if that surprised me in a good way or a bad way.
Well, I think it was just lazy. Like, this movie was the movie that we were trying to write in high school, which was really depressing. I thought about that.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
it's just these mishmash of scenes.
It's just gags with no connective tissue.
Yeah. And, you know, we were stupid and in high school. And that's exactly what this movie is trying to appeal to. But I don't even think it would be successful at that. Like, there's so many better movies for high schoolers to have this sort of fantasy through, like Superbad or Caddyshack.
It feels weirdly dated. Like, and not like, it's obviously making reference to a history of movies that comes from a certain era. But the movie itself takes place today. There's modern references that, you know, they're mm-hmm. using the appropriate technology. These characters don't act like they're from today. They act like they're teenagers from 1989. And the blatant misogyny is it's really uncomfortable in a way that maybe it worked in Superbad, A, because they sort of learned something about it, and B, because the actors are a lot stronger and the screenplay is a lot funnier. But Zach Perlman's
best Jonah Hill
from Superbad kind of thing, but he was so over the top horny. I was like, if this character doesn't end up gay by the end of the movie, I don't care about him. Like, if this is if he's not just hardcore fronting, well, I don't believe that a person can be this two-dimensional and boring.
Yeah, and just so gross.
Like, who would be friends with a person who is just like that?
And it was so frustrating because there were all these talented female comedians in the movie.
Nothing to do.
Yeah, like Cecily Strong, Kate McKinnon, let them be funny.
Yeah. I'll give a couple points to Gina Gershon for totally owning it. She's made an entire career of owning it in terrible movies and being the best part of them.
Sure.
But still no.
As far as the best part of the movie goes, I think the only part that even felt somewhat real to me were the parents.
I actually could have used more parents. Jim Gaffigan and I forgot who played the mother.
Yeah.
Their little scenes, which were too few and far between, were actually pretty good.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is they felt the most honest. Their disappointment when he decides that, you know, he's not going to go, and the mom's reaction to the motorcycles is great.
Actually, yeah, like Will Forte, he has a tiny little cameo in this. His stuff with the mom in regards to that whole barely subplot is actually pretty funny.
Yeah, that
it's
was
not like supported at all, but it's pretty funny.
That was like the only section of the movie that I sort of giggled at. There was once in a while when Bobby Moynihan would sort of like knowingly wink at the camera because you could tell he knew what exactly he was doing.
Yeah.
And I did appreciate that. Like, but I'm a Bobby Moynihan fan.
No, I am too. And again, he's him and Cicely Strong and all the people that we like or we're supposed to like, with the exception of Fred Armisen, who's terrible.
Yeah. He's just bad.
Everybody we're supposed to like does what they do. They're just given practically nothing to do. And we're supposed to believe this Graham Phillips guy who plays the lead, Danny Campbell, is like this poor put upon nerd who can't get girls. And he looks like he's like straight out of like a Abercrombie like magazine.
You know what, though? He has no personality. So I guess for people to not like him because of how boring he is, sure.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's something I hate from these movies. This style of movie is like they have to try to make this lead character so relatable and so everyman that they, there's like no character to them. Which, you know, like, I would have liked it had he been a little quirky or just had some thing going on besides the fact that he's going to Harvard and that his parents are weird. Like, his parents, again, were were really fun.
Yeah, he's pretty much defined by everybody around him. He's a completely passive character.
Yeah.
And it's a big bummer.
Also, though, I want to point out, we kind of talked about the misogyny of the movie.
Yes.
There was something that really bothered me.
Okay.
So first fat horny guy has sex with the wrong twin, right?
Which kind of saw that coming from a mile away, and it plays weird and
and that whole scene is whatever, but it's like, okay, he gets laid, cool, good for him. Then we cut to the main character and this girl that this sex object that he's been lusting after for the whole movie, right? And they finally get some
not the other twin, but Graham Phillips' sex object, the daughter of the mafia.
Yes. Yeah,
who couldn't be less interesting, but go ahead. No,
and also was like way too old, like she's playing a teenager or whatever.
Yeah, and she's clearly like 32. Yeah.
And so he finally gets her alone on the beach. And they're like, blah, 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 blah. And then it ends with them kissing. And she's like, we're not going to have sex, though. And it's like this weird, like, puritanical view of sex. Like, oh, she can't have sex because she's supposed to be this, like, she's the desirable one.
Right.
And the desirable one you're supposed to want to have sex with, but she's pure, so you know, like
it's a literal representation of the Madonna horror complex between her and Zach Perlman's Conquest.
Yeah, and it's just like so gross and not, and like we're beyond this in movies.
Yeah, you know? Everything about this movie is either dated, weird, or just wrong-headed or poorly cast and so tone deaf and. Yeah, I didn't care for it. It made me laugh a handful of times. I will say that with this much talent in there, comedically speaking,
sure,
there's no way that you can't get a chuckle in at least every once in a while. But I was just really kind of agitated by the whole thing.
Oh yeah, and Cicely Strong, this, you know, like she's supposed to be this sort of strong tomboyish girl or whatever, which they don't, like, they say that, but they don't really ever do anything
other than she has zingers, you know, or one-liners all the time. Her character is still basically passive.
Yeah, and then at the end of the movie she has to get pretty to end up with the hot Navy guy, and I'm just like, really? Like, Like, do we have to relegate all the female characters to what guy they're pining after?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at a movie, the movie that another one of the movies it probably wanted to be, which is Fast Times at Ridgemont High, mm-hmm. which came out in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That movie is about horny teenagers and all of that stuff, but it is like really not an easy movie as far as like it's gender dynamics and it's sexual politics. Like, that's a movie where Jennifer Jason Leigh is both played as a sex object, but then also has to get an abortion at one point. Like, that movie lets nobody off the hook.
Yeah.
And actually has balls and something to say.
Yeah, and I get, you know, Staten Island Summer, they just wanted to make a goofy
best comedy. Summer ever, like, yeah. Like,
but there's better ways to do that, and just casting comedians is not the way.
No.
You have to have a funny script. You have to give them something to do.
Mm-hmm. I kind of felt like, I say this a lot with modern comedies that don't play but have big ensembles. A lot of times I get the feeling like they have like a sketch of a script, or they have just kind of a thumbnail of a script, but basically their idea is, well, if we get a bunch of funny people to be funny, it'll mm-hmm. be funny.
I think there's something to that in general. Like, I think you do get a lot of that in like the Will Ferrell, Adam McKay stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is different because a lot of stuff feels so unnatural that I think it has to be scripted. Because, you know, a lot of these comedians have like improv backgrounds. They know how to do sketches. They know, like, if it was that, the bits would play better. But the bits that they have feel so canned and so artificial.
And so
that,
rote and just.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, and there's something about it I can't, like, put my finger on exactly other than it was paced awkwardly. It felt ravaged by bad editing. Like, they were trying to, like, kind of piece together. Like, there's this whole sequence where Zach Perlman's, like, trying to score weed, and it's, like, it drifts off into a whole other movie again. And, I don't know. I can't recommend it.
No, I give it 2 big ol' stinky feet.
Yes. And all of the movies we've been mentioning in regards to this movie, with the exception of Project X, which is maybe the worst movie ever made, are much better than this movie. And I'll throw in another one. I really like Adventureland, and I think that movie is again kind of doing what this movie is trying to do, but does it with characters that are actually interesting.
I haven't seen that one. Like I said, the big comparison for me was The Way, Way Back, and I think that was just because it took place at a swimming pool.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they have a big party in that one, too.
Okay. Well, that's the show. But thank you for coming on. Thank you for replacing Richard.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for watching the movies I asked you to watch.
Uh-huh. Thank you for watching this awful, like, I felt so dumb. I was like, great, the one time I make a Netflix recommendation and it's this big old stinky turd.
Oh, it I mean, when you're part of the fun of this segment is that's going to happen sometimes. Okay. Like, that's why we don't review things that both of us have seen, or else it would just be, we would be way too fast and loose with just recommending good movies all the time. Like, part of the fun, like, the basic thesis of the Netflix homework is it's a grab bag. You never know what you're going to get.
Okay.
And, you know, some people might like everything that we said and said, you know what, that sounds like a movie for me.
I doubt they'd be listening to this podcast.
I don't know. I never know. But you do things. So why don't you tell people where they can find you, Keith Foster?
Sure. They coming back soon tonight in San Diego. We are going to come back on April 11th. Actually, right now, we are currently trying to crowdfund a new theater space. So if you're listening to this and you want to help us out, please go to kickstarter.com/projects/the-raw-space-project. / some other stuff, but I think that should be enough to get you there.
We'll also post it on the Facebook when we post the episode.
Cool. I'll send you the link. Yeah. And I mean, even if you don't donate a lot, $5 helps. For $10, you can get some tickets to the show. There's, you know, there's better rewards going on up from that. And that's, we have about, by the time this comes out, I think we'll have about 2 weeks left.
Okay.
To raise $15,000. So that's, that's a lot. So anything helps. And
where can people find you? Do you have a Twitter?
Yeah, you can follow me at Keith Foster Kid. You can also find me on Facebook. TCP West has a show coming up at Side Stage Improv on March 12th. If you're in the San Diego area and you like improv, Side Stage Improv, they always put on a good show. So come check it out.
And I would imagine on your Facebook and Twitter, you probably post when you're going to do stand up or any other kind of events.
I do a lot of open mic stand ups. So I don't usually post if I'm going to do an open mic, but if I have a booked gig, I certainly do post it on Facebook. Actually, Facebook is the best way to keep track of me as far as performances. Because I will lazily post it to my page about a week before the show.
Right. All right, cool. And if anybody wants to get in contact with the show, if you have anything to say about Eddie the Eagle or Staten Island Summer or Talladega Nights next week or the Oscars, how did you feel about the entire thing? You can find us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com, and we can read your email there. We also have a Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where I post all the news stories we're going to discuss, as well as post the episodes when they go up. You can follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast, all one word. And I've been a lot more active on Twitter lately. I have a lot of friends out there who do podcasts, and we've been gabbing away over the Twitter space.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I think you've actually been more active than I have lately.
Maybe. Also, being unemployed helps as well.
Yeah, that's true.
We're on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Our regular Podbean archives is jabberonthedrone.podbean.com. If you're on iTunes or Stitcher and you listen to us through that, please leave a star rating and a one-sentence review. It helps people find the show because it, like, algorithms us up the ladder or whatever in the podcast.
What's that website again?
Stitcher Radio. Just look up stitcher.com/jabberpodcast or Jabber on the Drone, or just look up Jabber on the Drone under Google. I think Stitcher might be like the fourth or fifth link that pops up, but it's a good app to listen to podcasts. We're also on Pocket Cast and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as the Zune, whoever might still have one of those, and Player.fm. We're out there. Anywhere on the radio or anywhere on the internet, you might be able to trip over our podcast. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the content I provide for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. South by Southwest just started, and screeners are being dispersed, so I might have some reviews from that. Check out formerly of the Quarter Life Crisis podcast, which is no longer going. He has a cool lit zine blog thingy online called medium.com/panel-frame, where you can see a lot of comics and criticism and articles and listicles and all of that kind of stuff. And they're trying to get together a print zine to go out here pretty soon. Also check out all of our peeps out there, the ones that I previously mentioned about the Twitter conversations, friends who do podcasts. We have Leland from Olympia over at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com. Rod and Denise down here in Southern California, their music request podcast, The Listening Party, and our friend Patrick, who is going to be on the show here shortly to help us review Batman v Superman. At his podcast from Detroit, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. Nice. And
is that a wrap?
I think that's it. I think that's it. So thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye.
Bye.